And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative and just plain right. Just covering down on some major ground across the northern half of the most beautiful state in the nation. This one, Alabama. Y'all, I am saying this show goes like way down south of Birmingham, up north of Huntsville, Tuscaloosa, back to Gadsden, parts of Georgia, Tennessee, and even Mississippi, all thrown in just for good measure. All right, well, we're delighted to have a guest in studio with us. That's a second guest for the week, but this one actually carries a title with him, too. So sitting with us right now in the Right Side studio, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall. How you doing?
I am doing good. It's good to be back in North Alabama. I get to be with some of my home folks in Marshall County tonight for an event to be able to speak. But good to be in studio. It's always better than on the other end of a telephone call.
Oh, yeah. This way I can't talk bad about you or anything. You got to look you right in the eye. No, this is your stomping grounds. You're passing through on the way to home territory. Marshall County is where you hail from, right?
Yeah, you know, tonight the local Republican Party is holding an event, but honoring Circuit Judge Tim Riley, who I think you know served both his country and the military as well as the people of Marshall County for a long time. And so going to be able to acknowledge him tonight, give him a resolution from the AG's office commending him on his service because he's going to retire at the end of this term. And knowing him, he's not going to sit quiet. I think he's probably going to practice law and continue to do good stuff.
Well, tell Tim I said, hey, I've got a picture of he and I in our dress uniform together. He's a great guy, and we served in the same unit for a while. And he's one of the few guys I know who had Navy badges on an Army uniform.
I forgot about that. You know, and I'll commend him. You know, one of the things, and I know you're passionate about it, is the work that we do for our veterans. You know, one of the best things going in courts are our veterans courts.
Oh, yeah.
Where we acknowledge somebody's commitment to our country, their service, and allow for opportunities to be able to get services to veterans they need. Judge Riley's handled our veterans court in Marshall County for a long time. We see those going on around the state. And I think it's a good thing for the justice system to be a part of.
Well, and I'll be honest with you, it's near and dear to my heart because when I was in the state Senate, I was on the Veterans Court initiative that put together the framework for building that out. And then one of the first ones we did was here in Etowah County. And I believe Judge Ogletree at the time was the presiding, maybe it was Judge Milliken was the presiding circuit court judge, and we were really proud to put that in place.
Yeah, and I think it's done great stuff. And look, Judge Ogletree, what a remarkable history,
too.
Another one retiring.
He's retiring.
I know. I saw that the other night when I was here.
Off.
But another guy that has a wonderful life story to be able to tell, and I think is able to relate to people that is in his courtroom. And, you know, he's led the charge to really change lives and restore families.
Well, speaking of doing stuff and being busy, so I want to talk to you before we even dive into a few things you've specifically been involved with here of late. I want to talk, generally speaking, about your role as Attorney General. Because one of the things that I've, just me sitting back from afar and looking and sort of watching in, and even in my time of, you know, being in Montgomery and seeing how things work, I feel like you appear to have taken on the role of Attorney General far more, I don't want to say aggressively, more assertively, I guess, than I would say. You don't wait until the problem comes to you. You go out and you fix the problems before they even get to Alabama sometimes. And I've appreciated the fact that you have sort of taken on the role of defender of the state with that 10th Amendment, you know, backstop. And you've done so pretty solidly now for a few years.
Well, you know, and I would tell you, and thank you, by the way, that's very kind. I don't know that I would have fully appreciated the role and frankly the tools available to an AG had I not sort of walked in the office and had the opportunity to experience it, because I sort of walked in as a longtime prosecutor, sort of viewed the job initially as kind of maybe a super DA, if you will. You go all over the state, try cases, and it doesn't take long to realize that you've had more tools and more ability as AG, maybe than any other elected office, to be able to stand on behalf of the people of the state. And, you know, you've mentioned the 10th Amendment speaks very clearly that we have a federal government with limited powers. States are where truly powers to be exercised. And it's my opportunity to defend Alabama's sovereignty. And we see that on multiple fronts. I'm sure we'll talk about those today. But I think the growth and the maturity for me in the role, now I've almost been 8 years, is really being able to see how we can exercise influence over multiple issues that matter to the people of Alabama, whether it's defending us on our public policy relating to gender identity, and we can talk about that here in a little bit, but also making sure that we put rings around the efforts of the federal government to extend beyond their authority. If you look, and I think one of the greatest examples is around COVID and the vaccine mandates. you know, but for the actions of Republican AGs and for Alabama being directly engaged, three of the four efforts of the federal government would have never been set aside, partly because, you know, we're given the unique legal standing to be able to engage in these fights where a general public may not be able to do that. And so we get the chance to be able to exercise influence that way. But also it's one that, if we don't have Congress that can serve as that check on the executive branch, and if we have those in the presidency, whether it be the Obama time or the Biden time, that can't get their agenda through, then they're going to use the bureaucracy to be able to do it. And AGs are uniquely able to be able to fight that fight on issues across the spectrum.
And sometimes it's in-state. I know there are times when even within our own state, for instance, a piece of legislation gets passed, it's immediately challenged, it's here, and you're involved in some aspect of the challenge. And then other times I know that there are issues that arise, like I've seen the issues about Montgomery crime or gambling interests that your office has had to deal with, and that's right here in the state. But then other times you're filing amicus briefs with the Supreme Court of the United States on something that affects other states, but you don't want it to get to our state.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there's right now pending a direct action against five blue states, including California. And by the way, never bothers me at all to sue Gavin Newsom, right? It's always a good day. But and so we have that ability as well. And it's why I tell people this all the time. I think being the attorney general and the work that we do is the most fascinating part of state government. I have some really talented people around me that I have a great deal of trust and faith in, that philosophically care desperately about our state and believe in the fundamentals that I think are important. And, you know, every day it becomes that unique challenge to be able to get something done. And while, as somebody that knows that my time as AG will come to an end in January 2027, it makes me even more anxious about the ability to get things done before I leave.
Well, I totally get it. That being said, I think I may have even said when you were in a call-in one time on this show that the 10th Amendment is like a firewall. States actually have a sovereign right to defend the interests of their own citizens. You mentioned federal overreach a minute ago. And I think we've seen more of that in the last 4 years than I ever recall.
Oh, gosh.
And I mean, it's not like federal overreach is new, but nonetheless, the 10th Amendment was written, you know, by our founders. But that being said, I feel like that the need for that firewall, for states to have a say in what is best for their own citizens and their own rights outside of preemption by federal law, has been far more prevalent in the last few years.
No, there's no doubt. I mean, the Biden administration has seen no boundaries. You know, they have adopted this whole of government approach to be able to say, let's weaponize every part of the federal bureaucracy to impose our agenda. And I'll just give you the example relating to their sort of radical gender ideology. So they don't just want to attack Title IX, which has been very much in the news lately and really excited about all the wins we've had there. But they go back as far as to say the school lunch program through the Department of Agriculture that, hey, Alabama, if you don't change your definition of sex to include gender identity or sexual orientation, we're not going to give you the money to be able to feed hungry kids. Or they go to the EEOC and say, Commission, we need you to adopt a definition of discrimination that includes the failure to use preferred pronouns in the workplace or to allow for the choice of bathrooms to occur. Or WIC, which, remember, stands for Women, Infant, and Children, where they want states now to receive that money to provide assurance that there are bathroom preferences for chest feeding, and breastfeeding children. I mean, and that's their term, right? And so you don't usually think about the Department of Agriculture, the EEOC, and the whatever department controls WIC, being out there advancing a definition and an agenda that's totally foreign to what their mission is. But yet, that's how far this administration has been willing to go.
Well, it has, and it's been constant. It's been a barrage at times. I almost feel like it's been a cultural barrage. And granted, there's far more than just the cultural issues that you deal with, obviously. There's regulatory matters. But it just feels like the cultural issues, they've felt overly empowered, I guess, in the climate they've created for themselves. And so I'm glad that you and the other Republicans, attorneys general, have had the opportunity to stand in the gap. And by the way, am I not mistaken, you were the, I think, former head of the Republican Attorney General's Association.
Yeah, right? Yes. Had the chance to lead that organization last cycle, still stay on the executive committee.
Do y'all collaborate a lot?
We do. We do. You know, you take, for example, the fight on Title IX.
Yeah.
Alabama filed a lawsuit on behalf of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. And we try to develop expertise within individual offices. If you think back, West Virginia and Kentucky have led a lot of the fight against the Obama and Biden efforts to impose basically the Green New Deal through regulation. So we all sort of try to find some area that we can contribute for the greater good. And then, you know, one thing that, Phil, has been exciting, frankly, is you can recruit remarkable talent into AG's offices because of the opportunities for work that we have.
Yeah.
And the challenges we have, the cases that we're involved with that you just can't get anywhere else. And we don't really necessarily just see that in Alabama, but we see it all over the country. And so we've got a group of really, really talented lawyers across the country that are of like mind with a similar mission at hand and are able to do good things collectively together.
And we only got about a minute for the break, but what's the ratio? How many Republican attorneys general are there compared to Democrat, liberal?
Yeah, we caucus with 26.
26.
You know, not everybody is elected. Some are appointed by Republican officials. But, yeah, right now we're 26. Got really good pickup opportunities both in North Carolina and Pennsylvania coming up.
Nice.
Those are critically important, and we'd love to see 30 by the time I leave office.
Wouldn't that be a hoot?
Yeah, it'd be great.
All right, listen, we're going to take our first break right now. We're in studio right now with Alabama's Attorney General Steve Marshall. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We will be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative, just plain right. Just making common sense like a superpower. All right, so we're sitting here in studio with Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall. Mr. AG, so let's get specific. There have been a few things that you have been, your office especially, has been intimately involved in, and I've got to dive into first the WPATH, the WPATH, the what do they call it, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. You filed an amicus brief in a multi-state matter, I think before the Supreme Court, and this thing is just, I mean. So for our listeners who want to go to our resources that are up on the website right now, the article from the Christian Post is probably one of the most galling articles I've ever read because of the detail with which it describes what the WPATH wants to do to kids. And you filed, and it cites you as having filed one of the best briefs that's ever been filed because you've exposed so much and you just did it unabashedly.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can put out in 9,000 words. And to the extent anybody's interested in reading about this, it's also on our website as well with all the supporting documentation. But, you know, this goes back to a few years ago, the Alabama legislature, and I give Secretary Wes Allen, who was in the legislature at the time, a great deal of credit for taking on the role of Alabama protecting kids from the so-called gender-affirming care. We were one of the first three states in the country that passed a bill that said we're going to stop these cross-sex hormones, puberty blockers for children that are suffering from gender dysphoria. We're not going to allow gender-changing surgery to be able to take place on kids. And candidly, Alabama took a whole lot of heat for it, saying that we weren't doing right by children because, gosh, we have both these national and international organizations that say this is the standard of care for kids. And so when Alabama passed that law, we got sued not only by activist groups, but also the Department of Justice. Merrick Garland decided to come in.
How dare we?
Yeah, exactly. And yet, and I saw a commentator say it may be one of the worst mistakes the Department of Justice has made because it gave us the key through something that you're very familiar with called discovery to dive into what the federal government actually knew and what they were involved with. And here's kind of what we've learned. Is this was a broad conspiracy among trans advocates, lawyers that were involved in this litigation, advocates within the medical community who wanted to be able to move kids toward a transgender lifestyle, and most importantly, the federal government, who had a desire to be able to advance their own trans philosophy, led by Rachel Levine. And I hope folks know who that is. I think she's third in charge.
That's the dude that wears a dress
from
HHS.
And bragged about being a dad and been the greatest things that happened. And then he wants to deprive that of kids. And what has been so helpful here is that the science that is now being revealed shows that Alabama was absolutely right and that we have perpetuated not only a fraud on kids and parents, but we've actually allowed for harm to take place
permanent harm to them
long term. Yeah. And I think this is going to be one that the historians write about, maybe one of the greatest medical travesties that we've seen. But there's no doubt that in the case that we filed the amicus on was the Tennessee matter that the Department of Justice has taken to the Supreme Court. They're going to hold arguments on December 4th. I'm going to be there front and center as well. And while Tennessee's brief is really arguing about what's the legal standard the court's going to use to evaluate a state trying to protect kids in this way, because our record in Alabama is so much better than everybody else, because we've invested the resources to be able to dive into the underbelly of what has taken place, we had the opportunity to reveal that to the world through this brief. And I think, you know, most folks aren't really interested in reading legal briefs. I get it. You and I aren't always interested in doing that. This reads more like what folks would think. This can't be true. This has got to be a novel.
This is one of those where I'm reading the article, and it's just all it's doing is summarizing some of the points for your brief. But it got to the point that I was telling the staff here before the show, when I said, I almost can't even finish reading this article. I mean, I'm looking at things like, what's the one, the Eunuch Archive.
Yeah.
The Eunuch Archive, a group of fetishists who pose as academics that talk about making eunuchs out of children. I've got the
and by the way, relied upon by a medical organization to create a standard of care.
Oh yeah, I've got the fact that you got the WPATH or whatever we're going to call them, the WPATH. They literally talk about when someone identifies as a eunuch and wants to go through the process of castration, that it's gender affirming if you do. I mean, that's not a mental health issue. Apparently, it's a purely physical issue for them. And then they even go down to the point that they. There's emails that have now revealed that they were questioning their own findings and yet putting them out anyway.
And look, had a direct financial interest in allowing these to take place. You know, there's a great article today in the New York Times. I don't always say that, right? Great article in the New York Times. But discussing the fact of a researcher who's very much an advocate in the trans world that did a study on the effectiveness of these drugs in helping gender dysphoria with kids, that they refuse now to publish their data because the study didn't come out like they wanted it to. And we need simply to look to the CAS study out of Great Britain that absolutely shone the light that this is experiments on kids. And it's a failed European experiment that yet many in this country still advocate for.
So in the law, we have to provide the contrary opinions and the exculpatory evidence, but in the world of medicine they live in, they don't.
Oh, and they bury it. I mean, one of the things that's in our brief also is the fact that the WPATH commissioned John Hopkins to do a study on the evidence-based practices, and they buried the study when it
came out. So arguments come up in a little over a month, and then are you going to be providing oral arguments yourself? Or
no, no. This is going to be the state of Tennessee that will be providing oral argument, but Alabama's going to stand with them.
Outstanding. Well, I mean, I think that's God's work right there. I mean, this is literally one of those things that you like. I would want to be AG just to fight this fight.
Yeah. Oh, but there's no doubt that this is, you know, when I look back on my tenure, this may be one of the best things that we've ever done.
Well, your brief certainly caught some attention. If folks want to read in great detail, like, first of all, don't read it in front of your kids. But if you want to read in great detail, the article I've got came out October 21st, so Dateline 2 days ago, from the Christian Post. The title of the article is A Colossal Backfire Against the Trans Industry, and it basically cites your brief, Mr. Attorney General, as being one of the most profound pieces of revelatory writings on the whole transgender industry that's ever been published.
Well, so, we got a great team, and they've worked really hard.
Well, and thank you for saying that. All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back. We'll keep our conversation going with Attorney General Steve Marshall. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We will be right back. Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio, Phil Williams here live in the Right Side Studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national, sometimes the international, and oh yeah, like the dude just said, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Well, welcome to hour number two on Hump Day. We're going to get you all the way to go home time on a Friday afternoon eventually. But right now, we are still in studio with Alabama's Attorney General, Steve Marshall. Mr. AG, thanks for your time today, by the way.
No, this has been good to be here. Thank you.
Let's take another topic of this is like a sore topic. It appears that the Biden Department of Justice has nothing else to do except make sure that Alabama people know how to vote and vote right. And they don't want us to do anything to preserve the vote. They're trying to impede election integrity, it feels like, at every turn. I feel like Alabama is really a model for how election integrity should be handled. Wes Allen's done an amazing job, I think, at helping tighten things up. But right now I've got two stories on my desk. One is that a portion of the ballot harvesting bill that we passed at this particular last legislative session has been enjoined. It's not too egregious, but I'd like to get your thoughts on it. But the other is that apparently the DOJ feels it necessary to appoint election officers to oversee Alabama's elections.
Yeah, I feel pretty confident about our ability to oversee our own elections. By the way, do echo your assessment of Secretary Allen. I think he's working really hard. He's got a good team there. He's a great client, by the way, and so appreciate that as well. But look, this battle around elections is not unique to this cycle. I mean, if you remember, 4 years ago, we were battling the efforts of the left to open up our election laws in ways that are inconsistent with the legislature and how they passed it around COVID. You know, they wanted to do the, you know, take away the ID requirement, take away the witness requirements on absentee ballots. They wanted, you know, the drive-in Chick-fil-A voting method, apparently, that was going to be so effective. And we had to go to the Supreme Court twice and were able to win there. And so the fact that we've seen these most recent challenges are not necessarily unexpected. You know, the ballot harvesting bill, I think, was a great effort by the legislature to fight those that were abusing the absentee process to collect ballots, many of which were financially incentivized and completely contrary to some of the protections that our law would otherwise require. And while we were successful in defending that law on almost all of it, Judge Proctor did rule on one particular provision relating to those with disabilities or certain conditions that qualify under a federal act to somehow or another be, in his idea, unconstitutional and unlawful. And so we sought a stay from the 11th Circuit, didn't get it, but we still have the ability to contest Judge Proctor's ruling on that limited nature. And if we're unsuccessful, then I think the legislature has the opportunity to come back potentially and craft some language around it. But the good thing is the majority of the bill was upheld, and we have the ability to continue to prosecute, as we are right now in Clay County, someone for a violation of that act. And then we'll be obviously monitoring this election cycle to see if there are other violations.
And truthfully, I think Alabama, if I'm not mistaken, during the 2020 election, with all of the COVID madness that we were experiencing nationwide, with other states having complete panic attacks over whether they could even vote, much less whether their legislature would constitutionally provide means by which they could adjust their laws. No, the secretaries of state and whoever else were changing the laws themselves. Alabama stayed the course, and I believe we still had record turnout even with COVID.
We did, and we've seen continued record efforts in being able to register people to vote, and I expect that Alabama will turn out well in this upcoming cycle. There is no evidence that can be shown of voter suppression in our state. Despite, you know, the wailing and gnashing of teeth from many of the activists, the facts are what the facts are. You know, you used to tell juries all the time that facts are stubborn things. Mm-hmm. That despite your protestations to the contrary, what does the data show you? And it shows you that Alabama's made significant strides. It's one of the frustrations, honestly, within the battles that we've had on redistricting and what's gone on with the federal courts and the assessment of Alabama, is that it's like that has been failed to be acknowledged in a way that I think is truly appropriate, and we'll continue to fight those fights in the courts.
And well, we should. And like I said, I think Alabama technically is a role model in not only in the manner in which we conduct elections, but the manner in which we pursue our elections. And then also, oh, by the way, our results come in one night.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, let's go back.
How hard can that be?
You were vilified when you were in the legislature over voter ID,
voter
right?
ID.
That somehow or another that was going to be the end of voting as we knew it. And what have we seen? We've seen a transition to that across both red and blue states. And people understand that is a key election integrity component that is easy to implement.
But before I forget, let's specify too. There's also an attack on our ability to clean up our voter rolls right now. I guess they want illegals to remain on the voter rolls.
Well, if you're the Biden DOJ, you don't want to cooperate with the states in providing that data. You know, you've seen a little of the litigation that we have going on right now, and Secretary Allen talking about attempting to get that information from the federal government didn't receive it, and tried to come up with another mechanism to remove those who are in this country unlawfully from being on our voting rolls. You've seen Florida and other states sue the federal government to say, look, you won't cooperate, give us the data. And it's like you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't not cooperate with us to do something that we all agree is appropriate, and that is removing those who are ineligible to vote from the voting rolls, but then come sue us when we try to find another means to be able to do it. So I hope that at some point Congress passes the STAR Act, because that would solve that problem. Number one, it'd make it perfectly clear that you have to be in this country lawfully to be able to vote, but also places requirements on the federal government to cooperate with state election officials who are required to carry out safe, free, and fair elections.
Amazing, amazing. All right, well, listen, I tell you what, we got about 5 minutes left before I know you have to head on. You've got a speaking engagement to be to in another county, but I got to ask you. So lawfare is a word that I'd never heard before until the last couple of years. Lawfare is certainly evident. I think that whole of government approach we talked about a minute ago, it's almost been like a whole of the court system approach
right.
To go after Donald Trump. There was one of the particular New York cases, I forgot now if it was Letitia James or if it was Dalvin Bragg's case, but in New York, I look up and you're on the news. You and Tuberville have both been up there to stand by Trump while he's going through some of the lawfare. Just give us your on-the-ground perspective of what that was like.
Yeah, almost a surreal experience. I mean, you know this, but I've spent a majority of my professional career as a prosecutor trying cases. And, you know, as a prosecutor, you're supposed to chase facts, not people.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that they targeted Donald Trump. When Alvin Bragg was running, he said, I'm going to prosecute Donald Trump, without having any knowledge of anything that he may have done or not done. Tish James, my colleague in the state of New York, campaigned on, I'm going after Donald Trump, and that's not the way the system is supposed to work. And when we saw that prosecution in New York, which was clearly politically driven, a colossal waste of resources, by the way, for a city that desperately needed to be trying violent criminals and not Donald Trump. But to be in that courtroom and to actually watch it happen when Michael Cohen testified was the day that we were there.
You were there on that day?
Yeah, it was a head scratcher and one that, you know, frankly made me sad a little bit, seeing how the criminal justice system was being used for political reasons.
Yeah.
But also just feeling bad for the people of New York City who were not being served by both their DA and a justice system that was there to make their community safer. And I do think the more memorable moment, and, you know, we've heard a lot about McDonald's over the last couple of days,
yeah.
is during the lunch break, we went back into a little jury room, President Trump and I and J.D. Vance and Senator Tuberville and my colleague from Iowa. The Trump team had lunch catered. It was McDonald's. And spent a good 20 minutes discussing with President Trump whether or not he was correct in that the fillet of fish is the best item on the menu at McDonald's. I totally disagreed. Quarter pounder or Big Mac clearly have to be it. But it was quite the vigorous debate. And I'm not going to tell you that I convinced him otherwise, but I made my point.
You at least registered on the scale,
right? I did register on the scale.
So I guess the question then is, having seen the lawfare firsthand, I mean, has there been an abuse of the system such that there will be a remorse and a backtracking, or is lawfare the way of the future that candidates have to watch for now?
Let's hope not. I mean, it's the whole reason why we were engaged. We led the brief over the question of presidential immunity.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that we argued to the court and was glad to see the opinion that came out is this recognition that you can't expect political leaders to make decisions in office having to look over their shoulder wondering what's going to happen when they leave, and particularly if the opposing party becomes the party in power. That's not a way for government to function. It's not how you get good people to be able to run for office and to be able to serve. And that's not what our justice system is designed to be able to do. I mean, look, it's not ironic, is it, that Joe Biden says in office as president, I'll make sure that Donald Trump doesn't become president again, and Jack Smith indicts him, what, 3 weeks after the fact. And we've obviously seen how he's conducted that proceeding and what's gone on. You know, we're hearing the stories now of the congressional investigation into the Georgia prosecution and how there clearly was conversations between the White House and prosecutors in state court, which is unheard of. And all of this speaks to this idea of an administration run amok, a Democratic Party that will use anything at their disposal, right, wrong, in trying to defeat those that oppose them. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. And my hope is that lawfare is over and gone in what is 13 days away from today.
13 days. Well, Mr. Attorney General, we're down to it, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate you stopping by.
Oh, this was fun. Thank you.
Way to the home turf in Marshall County. Tell the Republicans. I'm speaking to the Tuscaloosa Republicans tomorrow night myself, but you enjoy your time, and thank you again for coming to Right Side Radio.
Always good to be with you.
Outstanding. All right, we're going to take a break. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We will be right back.